today on Against the Grain, if class solidarity, if organizing across racial and ethnic lines is a must for those fighting for social justice, what can we learn from what the Black Panther Party and the original Rainbow Coalition, the pre-Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition, accomplished in the city of Chicago? Jacoby Williams would say a whole lot. I'm CS, the Indiana University historian and author, joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is CS Song. It's a story that features many colorful characters, a lot of different communities coming together, and no small amount of political oppression and tragedy. And it's a story that resonates today, because police brutality and poverty and gentrification and so much else still afflict communities that deserve better, that crave and deserve justice. The story that historian Jacoby Williams tells in his book, From the Bullet to the Ballot, centers on the Black Panther Party. But it's not, as you might think, a tale of black nationalism and separatism, but rather a story about how the Panthers reached across racial and ethnic lines and formed important and inspiring coalitions with Latinos, whites, and others to push an anti-capitalist, anti-corruption, community-centered agenda. This original Rainbow Coalition had nothing to do with Jesse Jackson, but it had everything to do with the grassroots organizing and coalition building that culminated in the election of Chicago's first black mayor, Harold Washington. Washington, as Jacoby Williams makes clear, was drawn to the Black Panthers after Fred Hampton, the leader of the Chicago Panthers, was assassinated by that city's police and the FBI in late 1969. And then you have Jesse Jackson, who appropriated the name Rainbow Coalition. And then, Williams asks, is it any wonder that Barack Obama's political career began in the city of Chicago? Jacoby Williams is Associate Professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies and History at Indiana University. His most recent book is From the Bullet to the Ballot, the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party and Racial Coalition Politics in Chicago. A chapter from that book has been adapted to form a chapter in the new volume Civil Rights and Beyond, African American and Latino-Latina Activism in the 20th Century United States. When Jacoby Williams joined me from a studio on the Indiana University campus, I asked him about the popularity of the Black Panther Party in 1968, the year that its Illinois chapter was formed. And I should say that the Mulford Bill was a legislative effort to disarm the Panthers by prohibiting the carrying of a loaded weapon in any California city.
The first known episode happened in May of 1967 when a group of armed contingent of the Oakland National Headquarters Party marched on the state capitol to protest the Mulford Bill. Governor Reagan was there that day outside the courthouse, and that incident was broadcast not just nationally but internationally. And so that sparked the popularity in poor, underserved, particularly African-American communities, watching the ways in which Bobby Seale read Executive Mandate Number 1, understanding the ways in which this organization knew the law from the federal law down to the local municipal code, was able to maneuver and navigate that particular terrain, considering the dynamics and controversies of one being armed, but it means something totally different when there's an African-American male who's armed, and then marching in front of that, or not just in front, but onto the floor of the California State Legislature in Sacramento. So that sparked the interest across the nation, especially in Chicago, of folks who were keen and honed in on that kind of resistance and activism. Also, the way in which those survival programs, the party, advertised through much of their newspapers and speaking engagements, the way in which they were providing self-determination for the underserved and underutilized and valued members of their community in all these various programs, and advocating to folks their need to get involved in such campaigns. Couple that with the number of I guess you can say, celebrity philanthropy that was taking place during that period with Marlon Brando and a whole host of folks who were supporting the national chapter in Oakland and a lot of the anti-war activism. And so fast forward to the Illinois chapter, much of that activism took place in Chicago at the DNC, Democratic National Convention in 68. The big incident with the Chicago 8 trial was also took place later on in Chicago, Bobby Seale's gag. So all that media attention garnered not just nationally, but internationally, the way in which the party understood Cold War civil rights, something they learned from Martin Luther King, and advocating and highlighting the contradictions of the democracy in the Cold War context. So that brought them a lot of not just national but international attention in the media, and also provide them a platform to express and advocate and use propaganda in some ways to get their message across, to contradict some of the negative publicity they were receiving in the mainstream media.
They're often represented as a black nationalist party. You agree with that?
Yes and no. The party evolved over time, so you can't really pin them down as one thing. We can talk about them in the black nationalist context in a particular period. So the organization, the national organization, lasted from 1966 to 1982. So from its inception, yes, you can argue they're a black national organization. However, they were never a black separatist organization. So a lot of folks, or I should say popular lore, tends to mischaracterize the organization as this black version of the Klan or this black or as a black separatist organization, which they were never from its inception, which makes them quite different from some other popular black national organizations, like, for example, the Nation of Islam. I often joke quite crassly that if the Black Panther Party was an anti-white organization, much like the Nation of Islam was back then, they would probably still be around today, much like the Nation of Islam is today. But that's not what their concern was at that period.
So the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party was established on November 1st, 1968. Who founded the chapter and what were the initial targets of the group?
Well, the party had been active in Chicago long before November 68. It just had not received an official charter. And many chapters around the nation operated that way until they were actually recognized by Oakland. So Bobby Rush was able to secure that chapter's charter in November, and their main issues were mostly local issues. So in a national diasporic sense, and they will argue the international proletariat struggle, they linked their conditions with some of the revolutionary decolonization movements taking place around the world. But immediately in Chicago was probably, in my opinion, the most powerful political machine in the country, the Democratic machine in Chicago. And so their immediate concern was dealing with the political corruption and power of the daily Democratic machine, which entailed a whole host of issues, but primarily was urban renewal and gentrification, police brutality, lack of resources in terms of investment in segregating and desegregating schools and segregated housing. Those were the main concerns at that period. So most of their activism in Chicago had already, many of those folks who I mentioned already, like Bobby Rush and Fred Hampton, who became the deputy chairman of the organization, were already involved in student and civic and community organizing prior to joining the party. So, for instance, Bobby Rush was a member of SNCC as he was a student at University of Illinois, that time Circle, now Illinois Chicago campus. And Fred Hampton was the youth president of the NAACP, both of which had worked with Martin Luther King and the Chicago Freedom Movement when that movement came north in the 1966-67. So there was all this activism that was taking place prior to November.
SNCC being the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. What prompted the Illinois Panthers to create and this is the original Rainbow Coalition, and I understand this happened in the spring of 1969.
Correct. So I argue, or I should say the members themselves argue, that their organization is the original Rainbow Coalition, because usually when one states Rainbow Coalition, the first person in our current context that one thinks of is Jesse Jackson, who was not a member of this original group. And so those groups saw their common denominator as the Daily Democratic Machine in terms of the problems they were dealing with in their society and society in the city of Chicago at that time, but also in a larger context of dealing with poverty. From the inception, the party, speaking particularly about the Illinois chapter and consistent with the Black Panther Party in general, was an anti-capitalist group. And so realizing the ways in which segregation not only sparked or helped to maintain a lot of the problems that they had, that they figured that rightfully so, that they should join forces with others who were, what they will argue, reaping the same hell, so to speak. And those groups joining forces together could form a bond of solidarity, give them a sense of strength, and not just comradeship, but the ability to actually take on a political machine that was, they will argue, oppressing and exploiting all poor groups, regardless of race at that particular period.
So which people and organizations joined the Rainbow Coalition, became part of it? And I'm also wondering, you know, the Black Panthers, they were a socialist organization, and I'm wondering if the organizations that joined this coalition also had a kind of anti-capitalist bent.
Most of them, yes. So in the beginning, the Black Panther Party spearheaded the founding of the Rainbow Coalition in Chicago. And I want to be clear here that this kind of coalition building was not just unique to Chicago. This was actually a policy of the national branch of the Black Panther Party. They were creating coalitions as well in out in California with the Peace and Freedom Party, Irwakun, and a whole host of other groups. But in Chicago, what made it so powerful is Chicago then, and still is today, the most racially, residentially segregated city in America. And there were at least three to four, some will argue four, quote-unquote uprisings or race riots during that period. And so the idea of having such a coalition in Chicago through all that turmoil was not only a challenge, but should have been impossible. But it became probably the most poignant and successful coalition throughout the history of the Black Panther Party. So the first group, obviously, was the Black Panther Party. In Chicago, the city of migrants. Most of the members of the party have migrated from the South. For instance, Fred Hampton and his family from Hainesville, Louisiana, and they settled on the west side of Chicago. But most of these other poor groups are also migrating to Chicago for various reasons. So the first group to join forces with the Black Panther Party, due to the work of Bob Lee, his name was actually Robert E. Lee III, this African-American man from Houston, Texas, who was named after his grandfather, not the Confederate general, by the way, who migrated north to Chicago looking for work. He volunteered as a YMCA Vista volunteer, and he was organizing with a group of poor whites on the north side of Chicago, southern white migrants from the South, deep South, many of which from the Appalachian Mountains. Those youth in that community, Uptown, by the way, was probably the most horrendous slum in Chicago during that time, demonstrating that abject white poverty was not just relegated to the South. One of the misconceptions is that the African-American community that had probably the greatest slum, but no, it was Uptown, this poor white Southern community of migrants. And so Bob Lee, understanding the way in which hostility was projected upon these poor whites by other well-to-do whites, and he will argue coming from the South, he had never seen whites have to defend themselves to other whites, especially in a hostile fashion. And so he forged a bond with that group, and he introduced the organization to the Black Panther Party, as he was one of the field marshals for the Illinois chapter. And Fred Hampton will eventually join forces and integrate a Puerto Rican group led by Jose Chacha Jimenez and the Young Lords, who many of which themselves were also migrants, who are migrating from the island of Puerto Rico primarily, but also from the East Coast, moving west looking for employment, much like most of these Southern whites are moving from the South. So the groups on the up in Uptown, the Southern whites, they called themselves the Young Patriots, and their symbol was the Confederate flag. And the Puerto Rican organization, they called themselves the Young Lords, and they advocated for Puerto Rican independence. And so what Fred Hampton and Bob Lee was able to do, just the two of them, when they sat down and talked about this, they didn't share this idea with everyone, was because of the racial turmoil and conflict that Chicago at that particular period was known for. It was very heightened, those kinds of tensions. To try to see if they can forge a kind of bond and coalition with those groups, and they had success in doing so. And in doing so, they end up forging what they argue the original Rainbow Coalition. It was a Pentecostal preacher named Chuck Geary from Horse Branch, Kentucky, who was a member of JOIN, acronym for Jobs or Income Now. It was an offshoot of Student for Democratic Society, who also had moved to Chicago organizing during the Democratic National Convention. And he, at one of the meetings of the Young Patriots, the Young Lords, and the Black Panther Party, they were having a screening, advanced screening of a documentary called American Revolution II. And at that time, they hadn't established an official title or organization slogan. And so what Chuck Geary had done at this advanced screening was steal buttons, what he would call liberate buttons, from the Nixon Agnew campaign in a protest. And he repainted these buttons, red for indigenous folks, brown for Latinos, white for what we call working class hillbillies, black for African Americans, and so forth and so on, the colors of the rainbow. And Fred Hampton said, "Wow, that's a great idea, Chuck. That's what we call ourselves, the Rainbow Coalition," thus coining the term. So it became this de facto title, really a slogan for class and racial solidarity, and became an umbrella for these groups to organize around. So I emphasized the coalition and the ways in which ideas were shared. So I don't want to put this misconception to your listeners, give them this misconception that it was the party doing all of the leading. Yes, they were doing most of it, but they were learning from one another. It was really a ideal situation. So Chuck Geary was very much important to naming this organization as Fred Hampton is to coining the term. So you get this, the working of these Southern whites and African Americans in that context. And then Cha-Cha Jimenez and Young Lords, most of the activism that took place in that period, primarily led by the Puerto Rican community, also located on the north side of Chicago.
I'm CS. I'm joined by Jacoby Williams. He's Associate Professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies and History at Indiana University, and he's author of From the Bullet to the Ballot, the Illinois Chapter of the Black Panther Party and Racial Coalition Politics in Chicago. Tell me a little bit more about the Young Lords organization, who formed it, and what they were formed to do.
The Young Lords started out actually as a street gang. They were a group of first-generation migrants dealing with a lot of the racial turmoil of as being Spanish-speaking immigrants. Again, in one of the most racially, residentially segregated cities in America, a lot of racial tension. Chicago, the city of neighborhoods. I mean, you can move a neighborhood block over the border one block and you get a whole lot of racial tension and fights, even between white ethnics. So those territories matter to those communities, even to this day. And so much of what the Young Lords were doing at that period was trying to establish themselves as a community, as this new migrant group that began in the 50s with the Becerro program and other programs. We're bringing Latino folks in from all these various ways. And they were situated in Lincoln Park, which then and now today is like the gold mine of Chicago real estate. And so you had a lot of working class people in that community. And so you have a lot of gangs. And so they formed this gang to defend themselves from most of the other white gangs in the community. And in doing so, Jose Chacha Jimenez and others began to see all the activism that was taking place, primarily what SDS was doing with poor whites in this not too far from their community. You had the Panthers who were organizing as well. And then you had other groups who were already established in Chicago, like the Deacons for Defense and Justice, and a whole host of African-American groups who were already active in the city. And so the Puerto Rican community decided to learn from what they were seeing and model themselves after some of the work that these groups were doing and became a conscious community group. They began to deplore the so-called gang life and acknowledged themselves as, they will argue, revolutionaries and activists. So they began to organize ways of protecting the community instead of being terrorists or criminals or deviants in the community. They began to create programs, much like the Panthers did and SDS and others, programs that benefited the community, and slowly became an organization. So they evolved from the Young Lords Street Gang to the Young Lords Organization. And so Cha-Cha Jimenez gets most of the credit, at least from most of the research that I've done. And there's a whole host of people who deserve a whole lot of credit. But he is one of the most critical and most underrated and undervalued and unknown people in this period in terms of political organizing in Chicago. And much of what he and his activism was modeled after was actually after much of what Fred Hampton, who, in my opinion, is the most important political figure in the 20th century that very few have ever heard of. He was so dynamic that even folks like Cha-Cha and others were able to learn from him. So, for instance, in the book and in talks or lectures, I used to show a lot of pictures, and I can show you a dozen or so photos of Fred Hampton, who's invited as deputy chairman of the Illinois chapter to give speeches anywhere, whether it's Chicago, Canada, doesn't matter. And who does he take with him? Mostly Puerto Ricans, right, to demonstrate to the world that our Spanish-speaking brothers' issues and brothers and sisters' issues are equally as important as African Americans and other poor people, and building those kind of bonds and coalitions, especially around the city of Chicago. So Cha-Cha has a front row seat to the kind of organizing that the party is doing, and he's able to eclipse it in a number of ways. So one thing that the Young Lords were able to do that even the party hadn't done was, for example, create the city's first community-owned daycare center. Women in the Young Lords, they were almost equal to men, and understanding the plight of trying to be an activist and a mother at the same time, from the very inception, they had a daycare center. It took the party almost 5 years before they had one, 1972, until they were able to actually establish something similar. Just to demonstrate again that even though the party is leading, these other groups are also on their own establishing networks and activism and programs that the party itself learned from. So they're learning from each other. Fred Hampton just happens to be so dynamic that he is indirectly referred to as the de facto leader of this Rainbow Coalition when there's not really a established leader. But he's just so dynamic that everyone orbits around him and follows him. And so Cha-Cha, much of his activism, ideology, philosophy, political education is modeled after Fred Hampton. They mirror each other in a number of ways. They're learning from each other in a number of ways as well.
So you talked about the community campaigns and initiatives undertaken by the Young Lords in Lincoln Park. So, you know, you write about picnics and dances, toy drives, drug education, no doubt breakfast programs. How much more effective were community programs at mobilizing communities and getting the support of communities than, say, you know, campaigns that would come in with a lot of political propaganda?
So what the party ended up teaching most of these groups in the coalition was bringing a message to the people that was tangible. Every community, then and now, you always get politicians to come in and give you promises, to say what they need to say to get votes. Well, what the party and others were trying to do was take the profit out of what they believed was the human condition, that you shouldn't have to have money to have decent health care or decent education or decent housing and so forth and so on. And so many of the programs that the party established, they trained these other groups to do the same thing, whether it's the Young Patriots, these Confederate flag, Southern white migrants, or the Young Lords and others. And in doing so, much of these programs were started, for instance, if we're talking about the Young Lords and others, they are similar to what happened in the African-American community. They're started by this group, but they're really community-run programs. So Cha-Cha and others of the Young Lords, YLO, begin on most of these programs and picnics, but then the community takes them over and they run them and control them. And that's the power in many of these programs, much different from the typical way in which electoral politics or government resources are allocated towards communities. They're community-run. They self-determine. They don't rely on the state in any particular way. Their fundraising is on their own. The occupation of buildings or facilities is on their own. And the ways in which the community supports it, it gives the community not just gratification and access to resources that they were lacking, but it gives them the power to determine their own destiny, which was the underlying factor here. Also, many of which in these communities are, especially in this Cold War politics, this Cold War period, rejecting the idea of socialism, understanding that to say you're a socialist or advocating socialist ways, you can be red-baited. So it was also an indirect way of showing folks how socialism works by having them determine for themselves their own value and the ways in which they can control their future and their destiny. And so in a nutshell, they were actually practicing socialism without knowing that they were. And then once informed of it, no one wanted to get rid of it. And so it was a way of highlighting contradictions that here we are in this most prosperous nation, in this so-called democracy at this particular period. And you have all these folks who are starving for the same things, irregardless of race, whether they're black, Latino, white, Asian, the list goes on. And so much of what the Young Lords platform and politics and even structure was was almost a mirror image of the Black Panther parties in the way in which they organized their organization in terms of ministers and the ways in which their 13-point platform mirrored the parties, their ideology, the strategies, their methods, and because they worked. And so J. Edgar Hoover dubs the Black Panther Party the greatest threat to internal security in the nation in this period, not because they're Black men marching with guns or they're talking about self-defense, armed self-defense. No, because of the programs. These are what they call survival programs, survival pending revolution. And those programs were community-run programs that worked, that turned people away from capitalism. And that's why they were a threat. And so not only that, but if they only just worried about training poor Black folks, it wouldn't have been such a threat. But they're training everyone, irregardless of race, Confederate flags, Southern whites, to Puerto Ricans, and whomever, and training these folks how to be self-sufficient. And that's why they became the greatest threat to the current security of the nation. It's very much a socialist effort, anti-capitalist effort. And the communities, all these communities who in a city like Chicago should be pitted against each other, especially in terms of race, language barriers and so forth, and especially the ways in which conflict and tension were at an all-time high in those 60s, they're able to transcend race and find that humanity and that commonality in the human struggle in the ideal sense brought folks together. The universality of poverty and the ways in which one all suffering from the same dilemma, the same problem, and here are solutions to solving those problems that shouldn't be monopolized just by one group. And so that was the catalyst for the community. And I always use, for instance, my grandmother's example. My grandmother, who's alive during that period, my grandmother's, she's passed away now, staunch Baptist. And you can approach her. I use her as a member of the community, a typical member of the community, with that red book, that mild red book, talking about the so-called disciplines and all this revolutionary ideology. Goes right over my grandmother's head. She doesn't know anything about what you're talking about. You have guns, your arms, she doesn't hear any of that stuff. My grandmother reads the Bible. But as soon as you start feeding kids and working in those clinics and daycare centers and co-ops and community gardens, my grandmother be the first one in line. And so that's how they brought people to the fold. And so this is why people like my grandmother and others end up will take over those programs and they become community run centers. And even where the programs are located, I mean, many of these people didn't own most of these facilities. When you're looking at the African-American community, they didn't own most of any property over there. And so these were mostly white Catholic churches and others who decided to invest in the community in Lincoln Park, where the Young Lords were located again, mostly the white Catholic church and others got involved. And so even then, there still was these coalitions being made within those communities by folks who were once seen as the oppressors, who are now people who are contributing to the community in all these various ways.
So let's say someone wanted to become a member of the Young Lords organization in Chicago. Was it as easy as just signing up and getting your ID and then you're a part of this organization?
No. So the Young Lords, their weeding out process was actually modeled after the Panthers. First thing you had to do was sit in a classroom for 6 weeks, doing PE classes, political education classes, working out your mind. You had to know why you're doing what you're doing. You need leaders, not followers. That weeded out a lot of people. I mean, you have to sit in the classroom. I just can't get a gun and go do work. No, you got to know why you're doing what you're doing. Then you spent the next 6 to 8 hours a day doing community service. And I usually use that as an example, not just of the Young Lords, but of the Black Panther Party. Look, man, you're doing political education class half the day and community service the other half. You don't have time to hate people, especially white people. You don't have time to hate people. Too much work to be done. And so that's the Young Lords operating in that same fashion. Those political education classes were very important because it taught people not just the local laws, but philosophy. You looking at what's taking place around the world in terms of decolonization, the Third World International Proletary Struggles, and applying some of those theories and methods to your conditions and coming up with solutions to your problems. So you're not just learning about who they are and what you can do. You're coming up with solutions to solve some of your critical issues. And then you go out and what they argue, put that theory into practice. All that was modeled after the Black Panther Party. And they taught all these groups to do the same thing, the Young Patriots and others as well. And so that's why they were very effective in creating these kinds of coalitions, the party and the Young Lords. And the Young Lords were great for bringing people who you would never think into the fold, like the largest Latino gang, the Latin Eagles, as police of the communities. The party was not successful in doing that in a number of regards in Chicago, especially with the Blackstone Rangers.
Jacoby Williams is his name. He's Associate Professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies and History at Indiana University. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Jacoby. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Jacoby Williams is a history professor and professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at Indiana University. He is author of From the Bullet to the Ballot, the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party and Racial Coalition Politics in Chicago. That was published by the University of North Carolina Press. And he also wrote an article about the Black Panthers and the Young Lords in Chicago. To the volume Civil Rights and Beyond, African American and Latino-Latina Activism in the 20th Century United States. What should we know about police brutality and the extent to which that was a problem for the Latino communities in Chicago and how the Young Lords responded to that, what they did to resist brutality?
Police brutality was one of the catalysts for all the organizations at that period, as they all saw the police as protectors of the state or the property owners, especially in these mostly underserved and impoverished communities. So much of what the Young Lords did was they did a number of things. One, a lot of marches. They took over several police stations in terms of having sit-ins. They show up with almost 1,000 people and take over blocks where the police stations are to protest the treatment that they were receiving in the community. And the police force at that time didn't have many Latinos on it. And that was also a problem in Chicago. And then the ways in which the police operated was like an arm ring of the Daily Democratic machine. So almost anyone who had any dissent against the Daily machine, John Rice and others call this the triumvirate. The Daily machine controlled these communities using the police, politicians, and the mafia in a normal sense. So much of their methods were taking over police stations and protests, sit-ins, nonviolent civil disobedience. They even tried to make a citizen's arrest on one police officer who killed one of their members, and that police officer was off duty and no idea why he was on that neighborhood. Much to their chagrin, once they turned that officer in, those four Young Lords were arrested. They ended up being called the Quattro Lords, which was a method of that time by the police as well and the FBI, locking a lot of these members up so they can spend a lot of the resources they were using for their programs on bail and trials in order to hinder the progress that they were having. And so because of the success of the Young Lords and people like Chacha and others, he would eventually have to go underground later because of the activism of his organization against the police department and police brutality. Now, for the record, much like what's taking place now, I want to make clear that these organizations were not anti-police. They were anti-police brutality. And so in order for these issues to be resolved, they like the Panthers, the Young Lords like the Panthers, advocated for community control boards or community control of police or having some kind of accountability where the community had a say in what happened in terms of how the police their communities. And so much of those issues that took place then over 50 years ago are still the same issues that plague these same communities today.
So we got Fred Hampton, the very charismatic leader, one of the leaders of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. He was the deputy chairman. And one of the most notorious assassinations in Chicago happened on December 4th, 1969, when he and chapter member Mark Clark were gunned down in cold blood by the FBI and the Chicago police. What was the impact of that assassination in terms of political consciousness and in terms of who would step up and continue the work around building multiracial coalitions in Chicago?
So Fred Hampton, much like most people in the 60s, even in Chicago, there's a number of political assassinations that took place. He knew that the state was trying to kill him, whether it's the FBI or the Chicago police. The naivete, I would say, of the party at that particular time was that they believed that they stayed within the bounds of legality, that the state would leave them alone. In this fact, it was the state who stepped out of bounds and used all these various illegal means, like political assassinations, to stop this particular movement. What the State Department, in particular the Daily Democratic Machine in Chicago, you had this unprecedented joint effort between the local and the national to assassinate this common threat, this 21-year-old kid that they killed in his sleep. According to the autopsy report, that the cecal barbiturate that he was drugged with prior to his assassination, there was so much in his body he wasn't going to wake up again anyway. They didn't have to shoot the man. And what they figured is, if you cut off the head of a snake, the body will wither. What they didn't count on is the way in which his assassination actually galvanized the community, galvanized it so much so that the political machine in Chicago began to dwindle, that the Rainbow Coalition, which at that time was just a grassroots organization worried about their various neighborhoods, became a political party. And they organized as a coalition and ran people for various offices throughout the city. Even Chacha Jimenez, leader of the Young Lords, ran for alderman. And Harold Washer becomes the first black mayor of Chicago, running on as a Democrat, but on a racial coalition ticket, where these activists ran and organized his campaign, get out the vote for his campaign and others. Even Chacha Jimenez was his Northside precinct captain. And once elected mayor, he created what he called his Rainbow Cabinet and brought all those activists into City Hall. For the first time in Chicago history, you had Latinos, women, people of color, African-Americans, even disabled people sitting in City Hall with power. It never happened in Chicago history. And so once Fred Hampton was assassinated and kind of icon that he was, I mean, a lot of folks were scared off of joining the party. Unofficially, I put the numbers of the organization prior to his assassination at over 500 members. But after his assassination, the number dwindles down to about 50 or less. And so much of the activism of the organization, for their credit, was to expose the corruption and cover-up, much of which was carried out by the Daily Machine, the Chicago Tribune, and CBS. And the media was another apparatus that helped try to cover up his murder. But Chacha Jimenez, ironically, picked up the mantle. Because, again, there's no real quote-unquote leader of this Rainbow Coalition. They're a group that operated on an equal footing. But because of the charismatic leadership of Fred Hampton, Chacha ended up picking up that mantle and keeping the fight alive, keeping the struggle alive. In fact, Edward Hanrahan, who was state's attorney at that time, was supposed to be the heir apparent to Richard J. Daley as the next mayor. And his involvement as leading the assassination of Fred Hampton and immobilizing the Rainbow Coalition effectively against him ended his career. And so much of the way in which Chacha and that coalition was able to keep the wheels turning, in a nutshell, Fred Hampton's assassination mobilized the movement from a disparate band of activists in their various neighborhoods to an effective political campaign that challenged the machine and won in numerous campaigns in numerous ways.
Chacha Jimenez of the Young Lords, he decided in 1974 to run for, as you said, city alderman. He did not win office, but as you said, he became instrumental in the successful mayoral run of Harold Washington, who became mayor of Chicago in 1983. What happened to Harold Washington before that in terms of his attraction to the Black Panther Party and his decision to work with the original Rainbow Coalition?
Well, originally, Harold Washington was a, lack of a better phrase, a Daily boy. As Jesse Jackson and others would say, there's a lot of boys on Daley's plantation. So Harold Washington was no different at that period. But after the assassination of Fred Hampton, the arrogance of the Chicago police, usually when there's a shooting or and it results in a death especially, you quarantine the crime scene. And there's yellow tape, you bring in forensic experts and so forth. Police did none of that. They took his body and walked off and paraded it around and took pictures with it and left and just left the crime scene wide open. So the community and the attorneys and the Black Panther Party itself took people on tours of that apartment to demonstrate simply what happened there was just a political assassination, which helped to expose the cover-up of the state and particularly the city of Chicago and the state's attorney's office and much of what CBS, the propaganda of CBS and Chicago Tribune, all dispelled and revealed because the police department didn't quarantine the crime scene. So Harold Washington, like many of people nationally and internationally, came to tour that Bullets Raps department, became outraged at the wanton violence and arrogance of the police. Did you think you just kill a citizen and just call it a day? And so he ended up jumping ship as a result. And he and others were the people who encouraged the coalition to get involved in politics. So before, they were on the fringes of the political arena. And because of Harold Washington and others, this coalition has now become the center of the political arena and began to directly challenge the machine in all these various ways. So Harold Washington, like others, was galvanized by the assassination of this 21-year-old activist.
And so in some ways, would you say that kind of racial coalition politics in Chicago, it achieved a certain kind of milestone with Harold Washington's election as mayor in 1983, that this represented a kind of culmination of so much work on the streets, in the communities, on the ground?
That's a definite, not just a culmination of his election, the culmination of his cabinet. Most folks who are not familiar with Chicago politics may not recall some of those council wars. And this is the Democratic Party, which was functioning much like the conservative Republican right-wing extreme party that we have today in the city of Chicago as a Democratic Party, not in the segregated Dixiecrat South, but in the 80s, early 80s in Chicago, Illinois. And so when he created his rainbow cabinet, much of these council wars, I think they used to call it Beirut on the Lake, at that particular time, was between the Democratic councilman and this now new rainbow coalition led by Harold Washington. I think it's not only a milestone, it's a symbolic accomplishment, so much so that folks began to appropriate their politics.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jacoby Williams joins us. He is author of From the Bullet to the Ballot. That is about the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party and the phenomenon of racial coalition politics in the city of Chicago. And he also contributed an article about the Young Lords organization in Chicago and the Chicago Panthers to the new volume Civil Rights and Beyond. He teaches African American and African Diaspora Studies and History at Indiana University. Well, what happened to Bobby Rush, who was once the Illinois Panthers' Deputy Minister of Defense? What happened to his political career?
Well, he was quite successful at his political career, unlike others. He hitched his train to Harold Washington, who helped him become city alderman and then later U.S. congressman, where he still to this day is a U.S. congressman. And he became one of the thorns in the side of the new established Daily Machine. So after Harold Washington, which we as Chicagoans, for those who are not familiar, born and raised in the city of Chicago, we in the African-American community and other progressive communities believe Harold Washington was assassinated. So we have no proof, but after Harold Washington was assassinated, we have the establishment of this new Daily Machine with Daley Jr. And one of the main thorns in his side, the new Democratic Machine side, was Bobby Rush. And he even ran for mayor unsuccessfully a number of times to try to overthrow that machine. So you have to give that new machine a lot more credit. They weren't, was not a mirror image of the previous Daley administration or the old man Daley's machine. The new machine was a lot more pragmatic in terms of the ways in which it dealt with the racial dimensions of the city of Chicago.
What did the Chicago Panthers and Young Lords Alliance in Chicago, what lessons do they teach us? What lessons do they provide about African-American activism and Latino activism and the degree to which the two can provide a kind of synergy?
Provides a egregious example of what our communities need today, of a way of finding commonality despite the so-called, and I put this in quotation, so-called differences between these two communities, whether it's language or ethnicity or nationality and so forth and so on, but finding the commonalities, because when you, that's what the party and the Young Lords were able to do. They were able to articulate to their communities the commonalities, and the commonalities always, even to this day, always outnumber the differences. Why is that important today? Because here we have a new machine, the Rahm Emanuel machine, that's taking place currently in our context in Chicago. And Chuy Garcia, who also in a number of ways is just trained to Hail Washington in a number of ways, did not get that same support from the African-American community this time around that Hail Washington was able to get from the Latino community when he ran from office, much because of the divide and conquer narrative that the Rahm machine was so effective in articulating, demonstrating to the black community that these Latinos may get jobs and access and opportunities that they may not get, and pitting these groups against each other. The old divide and conquer technique worked egregiously this time around in the city of Chicago. So that coalition between the party and the Young Lords is one way of demonstrating what can happen with folks actually come together around the commonalities that they have, not look at each other as competitors, but in the human spirit, the universality of their plights, especially in the city of Chicago, of their poverty, because both of these communities are two of the largest impoverished communities still to this day, and see what kind of gains that could be achieved from that, much of which took place in the Washington administration, which is why he had so much pushback from the Democratic machine and those council wards. So it's a great model for what we need in our current society, especially with the polarization that Trump in this current presidential election seems to espouse, and folks from that pedigree seem to jump on that bandwagon in a proactive and aggressive way. We really need to mobilize as people of color, particularly looking at African-Americans and Latinos, two of the largest minority groups who, for some reason in various aspects, not just in Chicago, but across the nation, have failed to mirror a lot of the coalitions and activism and comradeship that the Young Lords and the Black Panther Party was able to do back 50 years ago.
You referred earlier, Jacoby, to the appropriation of this rainbow coalition term, the concept, the practice. And I'm thinking here about Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition or Rainbow Push Coalition, which I think a lot of people assume is or was the original Rainbow Coalition. How did Jesse Jackson's coalition differ from the original coalition? And yeah, to what extent did he borrow from the platform and ideals of the original Rainbow Coalition for his own political purposes?
For the record, I want to be clear that I have the utmost respect for Jesse Jackson. I intend to negatively portray Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jackson, in a horrible negative light. But however, as a historian, I can't romanticize. I have to call a spade a spade. I mean, what he essentially did was steal, or more, I guess, more politically correctly, appropriate a title of a movement and an organization that he had no connection to directly. He had some indirect connection, but not directly involved in the organization. So when the Rainbow Coalition originally was founded, Jesse Jackson had Operation Breadbasket at that time, affiliate of SCLC. By 83, when Hail Washington is elected, Operation Breadbasket had evolved into his own personal organization called Operation Push, PIP United Save Humanity in Chicago. After the election of Hail Washington, what he was able to see is the way in which that coalition in among the most racially, residentially segregated cities in America, with a whole history of racial tension, much of which played out during that election when Hail Washington was elected mayor, barely elected mayor, thanks to those 47,000 Latino votes, along with that almost 90% African-American vote, he appropriated the politics. Because remember, the Rainbow Coalition was not an incorporated group. It was a code word, a slogan of class solidarity to bring people together. No one owned it. It belonged to the people. And what Jesse Jackson was able to do was trademark it and call it the Rainbow Push Coalition. So if you say Rainbow Coalition today, you have to pay Jesse Jackson. It's illegal for you to infringe on that title. So that's the service that I highlight. Now, what he was able to do with that coalition in a number of ways was he's gone on to do a whole host of things for poor and underserved people, not just nationally, but internationally. I say that I respect him for that, but I like some members of the Black Panther Party, have a lot of disdain for the way in which Jesse Jackson appropriated the politics for his own selfish means. But as a historian, looking back in retrospect, I can also advocate or understand Jose Chacha Jimenez's position, who doesn't have any ill will for Jesse Jackson appropriating the title. He respects him for it. He sees that Jesse Jackson took what he called their little idea and dusted off and ran with it. And they had no idea it can grow into what it has become. However, it's very much a capitalist venture, which is not what the original Rainbow Coalition was. So when he stole the title in 83 becomes his pivotal year. 1983, Chicago Police Department's Red Squad files are sealed for violation of constitutional civil rights of activists and citizens. 1983, Hale Washington's elected mayor of Chicago. 1983, Jesse Jackson appropriates the term Rainbow Coalition, announces he's running for president, which he does in 84, much of which he runs as this black nationalist, which has nothing to do with Rainbow Coalition politics, which speaks to why he ended up losing that campaign. 1983 is the year that Barack Obama moved to Chicago to become a community organizer. So it becomes this pivotal year in the way in which the coalition's politics is appropriated by all these various people for these various means. And 1983 also happens to be the year that David Axelrod becomes this political consultant after leaving the Chicago Tribune, much of which is modeled after coalition politics. He's a genius in the way he's able to take the ideas, methods, slogans, and et cetera of that organization into a whole nother plethora they may have never dreamed of. And so the title of my book, From the Bullet to the Ballot, is a play on Malcolm X's speech, The Ballot of the Bullet. I reverse it, the bullet being the Panthers, the ballot actually being President Obama, arguing directly that it's not by accident the first black president comes out of Chicago using racial coalition politics. It's not a new phenomenon, at least not in the city of Chicago. However, I'm not calling Barack Obama a Panther. He's not a Panther, Bill O'Reilly or anybody else who's listening. He has no direct link to the Black Panther Party. What I argue is, like Jesse Jackson, who appropriated the politics, so did David Axelrod, who introduced some of these ideas to Barack Obama, who was not unfamiliar to them as a community organizer in Chicago, doing that kind of grassroots organizing, you're going to meet these folks. All three of these people appropriated the politics of the Black Panther Party's original Rainbow Coalition for their own political means. Now, all three of these individuals would state that they learned from Hale Washington, that Hale Washington is their idol. Hale Washington is the symbol that blessed them into the political arena to give them the ideology and methods that helped their career. All three individuals on the record saying this, and that's fine. I'm okay with that. If Hale Washington was alive, he would have no problem saying that, no, I work with this coalition and I value this coalition that goes back to the Black Panther Party. I put some of these people in my cabinet. We will have no problem saying that. Plus, you will commit political suicide claiming that your politics is modeled after Black Panther Party running for all these political offices. So I understand that. I have no problem with that. But there are appropriations that are obvious. The most egregious one, obviously, is Jesse Jackson, who was a capitalist, appropriated the title of a socialist organization. And he's still doing capitalist ventures. And I don't have time in this program to go into all these anecdotal details about the ways in which he clashed physically and sometimes with this coalition and then ended up appropriating the coalition. But who can blame him, man? Look, you black man got elected mayor of one of the most racist cities in America. I would have done it too. Mm.
Jacoby Williams, Associate Professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies and of History at Indiana University. You can check out his book, From the Bullet to the Ballot, the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party and Racial Coalition Politics in Chicago. In fact, we've got a link to that book and to Jacoby's faculty page at Indiana University on our website, againstthegrain.org. And a chapter, From the Bullet to the Ballot, was adapted by Jacoby to form a chapter in the book, Civil Rights and Beyond. Thanks so much, Jacoby, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.